Hello and welcome to episode 18 of Chips of Chorlton. I am joined as ever by Andy.
Hello.
By Robin.
Hello.
And by Duncan.
Hey, yep.
And we are joined this week by a super guest from seminal Manchester band Ocean Size. And probably fair to say, making Biffy Clyro sound better live.
I think that's more than adequate.
Yeah. Mike Fenart, thank you very much, Mike, for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So what have you been up to, Mike, apart from headlining festivals as you do nowadays?
I've been making you guys wait for an hour because I don't know how to work iCal. And so the Chips of Chorlton, on which this podcast is eponymously named,
yep,
did not get eaten by me tonight.
I think I saw you have one.
Maybe
it was subconsciously.
I immediately regretted it because it was rate cold. I've not done that. I'm having a couple of beers on an empty stomach, which doesn't bode well.
So how have the shows with Biffin been? The Scarborough and the Isle of Wight ones.
We did two gigs, as you say, Scarborough and Isle of Wight, and that's the first gigs I've done with first like proper rock shows I've played with them in a year.
Oh, we did the acoustic stuff.
Amazing. Yeah, it was good. Fun. I'm not an acoustic player, so I can't say that I had the best time. I find acoustic, well, you know, like electric guitar, I find more pleasing to the ear, and it's better in terms of sort of physical fitness because you've got to stand. You don't sit down and play electric guitar, and if you do, then you need to have a fucking word with yourself.
So coming up, a review on George Ezra at Glastonbury.
We'll come to that. I'm not having it. So it's been fantastic. We played three new songs from their new album Balance Not Symmetry, which is fucking, I'm biased, I'm always going to tell you that I think that Biffy are fucking amazing. I'm not in the band, so I feel like I'm entitled to say what the fuck I want about them. And it doesn't sound big-headed, but I fucking love what they do, and I think this new album is... You can tell that it's kind of away from Watchful Eyes. It's kind of them making really stupid stone decisions and going ahead with it. Great. I think there's just... Yeah, some really, really weird stuff on it.
Well, I mean, that was like our introduction to Biffy. Like, we sort of missed the first album really coming out and missed the buzz around that, and then like got like stuck into the weird stuff.
Yeah.
And that's like sort of quintessential Biffy, you know, like Infinity Land Biffy.
Let's Go Bliss. Yeah, we're absolutely obsessed
with it.
Me too,
you know, and I can still hear new things in that. That side of them is still there.
I think we've ever seen anyone actually transition like Biffy anyway.
No.
I still think it's a blue... I still think it's an imprint that hasn't really been seen before or after.
Absolutely.
Where someone has come from complete left field and basically finding their own sound between alt and indie at a time where there wasn't really much demand for a Jaggy Snake.
No.
And then completely turning it around and going, you know what? I think we can nail MTV too, and I think we'll do it right now. And they did it so with so much certainty as well. Yeah. Like it was there.
I feel like they haven't lost any of the core Biffy fans either. They're all still like on board from like the super weird, sort of like mad introverted Biffy to like the sort of big like epic stadium Biffy.
Yeah,
like they're all still there with it.
I think so. I think that there's a lot of pride with them as well. And again, the idea that some fucking guy at Warner Brothers would hear Jaggy Snake and go, "We got to sign these boys," and that's what happened. That's what happened.
I think that's essentially why we started.
The fact that they could write Jaggy Snake and still sell out Academy 2 at that point.
We still play that. But like, you know, I remember when Vertigo came out, and we were doing our first album, and it was the same producer, Chris Sheldon, was doing it, and he just got Vertigo Bliss mastered and sent to him, and he was like, "Oh, you can have a listen if you want." I was like, "Yeah, leave it with me," thinking I'll fucking rip that and give it to everybody in the band. He was like, "Yeah, don't I was like, "It's fine." And then we all listened to it over and over again while we were making that first record, and just thought, "We're fucked. This is the best fucking record." And you know, we all thought Biffy were great. We thought the first album was amazing. I remember Steve very specifically saying, "Fucking love Biffy, but they get away with murder." Because like certain chord sequences, big choruses and all that, it's like those are things that Oceanside would have rejected. Nobody would have dreamt to bring in a chorus in like that in Oceanside. You'd just be laughed out of the fucking room.
We're the same.
I was gonna say, how about Glitter and Trauma?
If anyone
would come with that idea to your band, you'd just be like, this ain't gonna work.
No.
Yeah, I mean, and even on the other side of it, like Captain and stuff like that. Like,
but it's,
I don't know, they sell it really well. I think it's partly to do with the live show as well.
Yeah.
Like, they play it with, like, such ridiculous energy.
Oh, they fucking bring it. You know, like, Simon, just to watch him is tiring, you know. Yeah. He's strumming and he just doesn't let up. It's just... They've just always been really good. And, you know, it helps that they're all really fuckable. I think if they were really ugly, then we might not... I might not be on this podcast.
Robin.
Yes.
Robin, last time on the podcast, you were about to leave for Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're recording. You just come back from Japan.
I have, yeah, yeah.
So how was that? What's going on?
Oh, it's awful. Absolute shithole.
Freezing cold, I imagine, as well, this
really
time of year.
Grim, yeah.
Terrible food.
Yeah. no, to be honest, it was an amazing trip, and it feels like I've been away for months because it was such a busy, intense period, getting all the filming done for the film and getting all the audio that I need for it as well. And, yeah, it was just incredible. Met some amazing people, travelled a lot, and the jet lag got the better of me.
Oh, for fuck's sake, mate.
I know. I felt like... absolute death. We went to watch some kabuki, which
that
is...
That sounds sexy.
Oh, it's really not. It's like ancient Japanese opera. Ooh. And it's painful to listen to. It's like... It's
you
just
mean like
not,
in like a shrill sense?
Yeah, it's like...
Oh, okay.
I can... I'll show you a video in a bit. It's really... It's really pretty grim, but that was like 3 hours and we just arrived. Like, and our tour guide... tour guide, fucking hell, our translator.
What was his name?
He was called Sushi.
Right, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just checking. It gets better. It gets better.
Yeah.
Your whole trip was booked by...
Sushi was recommended by a French woman called... Mrs. Croissant.
Get the fuck out, man. No way.
That's fucking outrageous.
It's all true. It's all true. But yeah, anyway, we're going to the kabuki and Sushi said, like, I know you're really jet lagged. Like, don't fall asleep during this because it'd be really disrespectful. And like, we're halfway through it. I got told off for filming it. So I've already made a good start in the country.
Bit plastic, though.
And then I looked over and Sushi was asleep.
Oh.
What about the sex dungeon?
The sex hotel. I'm sure you're
whatever.
Referring to. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Did you hotel book the dungeon? Sex hotel?
I did.
Is that what you did? Right.
What this happened was, this there? Were you getting confused with innocent, yet? What was going on?
No, I did it on booking.com. This was a week before we went. We had
was it booking. Was that, are you sure?
BookingXXX.com, is that though?
There was one night that I needed to book in Sendai, which is a city about 2 hours north of Tokyo. And I found this hotel. It was quite cheap and had good reviews. And then I found out why. And we got there and Sushi was like, what's this hotel called? It's like, I think this might be a Japanese sex hotel. What? This is like a Japanese tradition, really. These hotels were set up for people... decades ago when you'd have like 3 or 4 generations of a family all living in the same house, and because the walls in Japanese houses are literally made out of paper, young couples would have to go to these hotels to have sex. And now it's just become a place where businessmen go and have affairs.
So as far as the film you're doing with Clara, what mm-hmm. happens next? How does it work? Do you go away and write the music? Does Clara go away and edit some stuff and you come together, or do you write separately? What goes on?
Yeah, well, we're going to kind of work separately but meet up every week and make sure we're on the same page, really. So I'll use some of the audio that I've captured there as basis for some of the composition, and then as she's making the film, we'll work together and get it to hopefully all work.
Good.
In tandem. Yeah.
Good, good. Do you know when you're going to release it? What's the date?
I reckon it'll be probably... January or February next year.
Okay,
so we'll do the screenings with Live Score again.
Fantastic. Yeah, brilliant. Looking forward to it. So another thing that's been going on this weekend is Glastonbury. So we're here on the Sunday. We got it on the background. I'm not too sure who's on now.
I think it's still Billie Eilish.
Not
Billie
too Eilish. Sure.
Sorry,
Billie Eilish, mate.
Sorry, I'm set.
I'm with him, man. I've no idea.
How have you found this year's Glastonbury from the footage? Because I suppose we were all there at the previous one in 2017.
Yeah. Obviously,
unbeknownst. It's because I was, you know, the backstage enclosure to the pyramid stage.
Oh, it's totally closed off.
It's quite hard to get into.
Closed off for the shit munchers.
Yeah. You're not you little shit shovelers on your fucking Vauxhall Cavalier fucking stage at the back.
Yeah. I mean, I could see it.
It's a fair
point.
Do you remember, Rob, on the Friday?
We had an interview, didn't we?
Well, we had an interview with Six Music, and the Six Music radio hub is in that area you're talking about. It's in that backstage area shared between the other stage and the pyramid stage.
Yeah.
And we had to go to three different entrances, basically going, hi, yeah, we've been invited here by Six Music for a news, Six Music news interview with Alcopops. They were like, who are you again? It's like, yeah, we're this band. Like, and where are you playing? Yeah, we're playing this stage. Yeah, can you just let us in? Like, we got invited here.
Yeah.
Don't make us out to be fucking aliens. I know Blossoms are in that canvas. I couldn't give a fucking shit. If I want to find Blossoms, I'll find them on the fucking A6. Doesn't matter. Like, I don't... What do you think we're trying to do? Like, we're very hungover, and you've invited us here, and yet we're just getting told that we're in the wrong place constantly.
And I mean, with that rant as well, and they still didn't let you in. They did get backstage.
Sorry, I don't know where that came from. That was really annoying, because they were literally the only people backstage. Like, give a fuck.
Well,
unless they come on our podcast, in which case, please come on.
They're very protective of the kind of folk that are back there. I'm not talking about the bands as such. It's the fucking the hangers on, the liggers, are of a different class, right? So I've got a story for you, right? So we're doing our gig. I'd taken my missus and my lad, who at the time will have been just five. As I've mentioned in the pub, he doesn't give a fuck about music. He's just not bothered. He's not impressed that, like, I'm playing to fucking 100,000 people on the pyramid stage. He'd spent most of his time in the kids' field, which is about as big as fucking Tea in the Park.
Yeah.
And he was buzzing because he had acquired these balloon swords, you know, like model balloon swords, right? So there's footage of him up on the fucking wee side of the stage, but at pyramid stage, having a great time just twatting everybody with these balloon swords, not watching me fucking having the time of my life, like defining moment, living the fucking dream, doesn't give a fuck. Anyway, so we do our gig, he's got his balloon sword. I walk off the stage at the end of the gig, I'm feeling fucking like $1 million, like, but like, you know, sweaty and horrible. Yeah. Bit pissed, you know. And I get into the dressing room, just dusting myself down. And Vic, my lad, starts screaming the fucking place down like he's just been dismembered. Like, proper screaming. So I go out going, what the fuck is going on? And Beth, my missus, is like, David Beckham just popped his balloon.
Fuck off.
And I look, and it's David Beckham just in the corner, like incognito with a big fucking sun hat on, looking at me like going, I'm sorry, man, I'm sorry. No,
that's
I'm
amazing.
Like, and in front, like, Beth's holding Vic, you know, trying to like console him, and in front of him is this woman going, I'm sorry, are you all right? And I look, and it's fucking Victoria Beckham.
Fuck off.
Right, it's true. And she's like being really, really nice. She's like not gonna let him, you know, she's not gonna leave. They're there to see Ed Sheeran, they've got their own fucking dressing room and everything. Didn't watch yours, obviously. So she's trying to console him, but she keeps saying, oh, I'm sorry, would you like to meet David Beckham? And eventually, because he's just looking at like, what the fuck, who's that? And eventually Beth has to just say to her, I'm really sorry, he doesn't know who David Beckham is. So, I'm like full of piss and vinegar because I've just played the best fucking gig of all time. And I go, so what the fucking hell are you playing at? You? Have you got any kids of your own? And she's like, I've got fucking 100 of them. I was like, I know, I'm just having a laugh. And with that, Biffy's tour manager shows up with like this great big fucking flaming lip style beach ball. And Vic's like, yeah! It's just like David Beckham can make a swift exit. It's like trying to say to Vic going, have you any idea? That's the most famous fucking couple on earth. I mean, I don't care about football or the Spice Girls, right? But I was like, Jesus Christ.
So backstage when we were at Glastonbury was your dentist, wasn't it?
Yeah. So we might Yeah, that was, we might have mentioned this before about Pete and Duncan's dentist being the only fucker who was side stage watching us.
So who have you liked from this year's Glastonbury? What's the main standout?
Probably got to start with Stormzy, really.
Stormzy, brilliant.
I only know a couple of Stormzy songs, but I thought it was brilliant.
He was on too late for me. I was in bed, about half ten.
Let's
That's late for me.
Hey, you know, I'm lucky that I can watch it all back. I enjoyed Tame Impala because I'm a old school, boring, anything that's remotely psychedelic, then I'll take it. But I thought they sounded fucking incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, I've not caught that yet.
It's a fucking absolute dynamite.
It's always one of them, when I don't go to Glastonbury, I look at the lineup and go, oh, it's shit. He wants to be there. Then when it comes on the telly, I'm like, oh, fuck, everyone's amazing, aren't they?
But ultimately, like, the less... When you're at Glastonbury, the less bands you watch, the better time you'll have.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you allow yourself to be open to the idea of being surprised.
It kind of feels like, well, every time we've gone, it feels like it's centred around the Park Stage area now, isn't it? It's like Park Stage, Crow's Nest, Rabbit Hole.
Yeah.
The sign and the big helter skelter looking thingy mabob.
The Park Stage seems to be where all the other stage bands have sort of graduated to.
Definitely,
now.
Yeah. But I remember because we played the Crow's Nest, the tiny little like bar at the top of it.
Yeah.
The day before we played at the Williams Green, but that was a brilliant introduction to Glastonbury because you're sort of high enough to see everything. Mm. You're around the Park Stage bit. You can just sit there and, you know, have a beer and just.
I've not been
vaguely here. It's really good.
Back to Stormzy.
Yeah.
It was fucking great.
It was fucking great.
it was fucking so good. And it needs watching back because, as we said before, he hasn't got the songs, but it's not about the songs. It's about the whole message. It's about using the idea as a platform. How do we feel about the fact that, and I know you don't like this getting political, Neil, but like, how do we feel about the fact that the whole thing is getting politicized? It's getting criticized by the right and the right-leaning media. The fact that it's now being called, I know it's not Jazz Fest because Jazz Fest is something else, but it's being compared to Jazz Fest.
I think it will get politicized because he's black. I think that's frankly...
Is that where
my head's at with it. I think, you know, when a black man is successful, that there is some sort of instant kind of, well, what the fuck can we pin something on
difference between the tolerant and the intolerant. The when I saw it, I had nothing but pride in a sort of sense, like he's sort of representing a Britain that needs to be represented.
Absolutely.
And ultimately I was just nothing but proud to more than probably anyone else British to
any highlights of the set that you'd say, any particular highlights?
I thought it was all amazing. I mean, maybe apart from Chris Martin.
I love the sweet like chocolate
bit. That's great.
That was great.
That's really good. But no, it's brilliant. And
I didn't even realise the fuck Boris bit when it happened live. You have to watch that back to realise the enormity of what's going on there.
Mm. I suppose talk about what we said in the last podcast is that's what the press kind of really latched onto is that language allowed? And are the BBC allowed to sort of, you know, play it?
Ultimately,
you know?
Glastonbury, since as far as I'm aware, has been... not sponsored, but I've been a huge advocate of CND and Greenpeace. Mm. Now, whilst Greenpeace is undoubtedly an environmental concern, it's a political pressure group so why wouldn't the headlining band be an overtly political outspoken person? Why not? Is it just because he's a person of colour that the Daily Mail are freaking the fuck out? It's like, it's so transparent.
There are so many things all happening at once. It's all spinning like a massive lazy Susan. There's this, I don't know why I've decided to pick the most middle class.
Chris Morrison or something there, man.
Massive lazy Susan.
That's brilliant.
What's a lazy Susan?
When you're at a restaurant and there's a big
usually
circle.
Usually Chinese restaurant.
And there's a big sort of circle and if you've got your main dishes and you want to share it,
you can all share
the dishes. Spin around. Anything else this podcast?
I wish it was a
check out.
At this point, Mike, I wish it was a sexual thing. Honestly, right, okay, so here's the thing. So many things all happening at once, like a big lazy Susan. I've forgotten them all now. But the point is that, like, people have to, like, it's about making the whole country, which is shit for doing so, like, realize that the headliners is not really what it's becoming about now. Like, I would say the menu of the headliners gives you everything you need. Like, Stormzy has the platform, the Killers have the songs, the Cure's going to bring it home. It works over three nights. Mm-hmm. I think this whole thing is going to become, like, because we have to look at our generation of bands. Who is there to really fill these gaps now in the headliner slots? There aren't enough of us coming through because we harbor for the past so much. And it's all going to come down to the legend slot. You're going to start getting bands who know the legend slot now, who will be playing that legend slot knowing what it is. And it's all going to come down to that. But the fact is, this country's shit and needs to get over itself and just let a thing be a thing. And there's other channels. Change over.
Well, exactly. I know. And so many people whinging about it won't have watched it. And that's, you know,
as far as I'm concerned, any band, no matter where they are on the bill, if they're causing Daily Mail and their fucking Poisonous Readers to start coming out in a rash and going bald, then they're fucking absolutely fine with me. And the chances are, I think it's important. It doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter if I like them or not. But if they're doing anything to upset that, then fucking good on
them. Well, we touched on this last week, didn't we? With the band whose lyrics are Kill Tories or whatever.
Children.
I mean, we did talk about it last week, but I mean, it's, you know,
I think that's maybe a little bit too far.
Exactly. I think that's basically the line that we
kind of felt that George Ezra's songs could all be Proclaimers songs. That's, like, I had that realization.
He's fucking wank. He's the worst.
But no, everyone says he's a lovely chap, though, and I believe that.
Don't care.
He was on Vic and Bob. That's pretty good going.
I did see that.
I had Frank Turner on Six Music, and I thought he was absolute fucking trash, like, really fucking awful. Like, he's got a new album that, to be fair, actually, it's got quite a nice ethos about it, trying to bring attention to sort of, like, you know, figures that haven't had the attention that they deserve in the past. So there was the woman who was only recently introduced to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, who basically invented rock and roll before Elvis. But anyway, so he had all these nice lyrics about her and whatever, and then put together a song about it, and it ended up sounding like Stacey's Mom by Fountains of Wayne. And it's fucking everything he does, I hate.
I mean, but let's say, though, that we liked Million Dead when we were 16. Though,
yeah, but that was a long time ago.
Who have I enjoyed? Enjoyed Mac DeMarco. Enjoyed Idol's set on the Park stage.
Fucking brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a bit of a rant about
Please,
this, right?
Go on.
Now, I really enjoyed the Idol set. I thought it was, apart from just musical fucking carnage, because it seems like the drummer's holding it together, the bass player's holding it together, the singer's fucking nailing it. The guitars are just going absolutely rage, doing whatever the fuck they want. It's just a mess. It doesn't matter if they're in tune or out of tune. They're just going, making a load of racket. They really, really rose to the occasion. It clearly meant a lot to them. They talked about it a lot when his wife came, because he started crying. And when his wife came on and told him that she loved him, I was fucking in bits. I just thought, this is special. We've really seen something. And then you've just got every twat on social media going, oh, they're just a fucking fake punk band. They want to listen to some proper punk music. And you're like, punk rock is just the most fucking elitist bullshit. To me, it's like, if I sat here now and listed three, I couldn't tell you that I'm into punk rock, but I could tell you three punk rock bands that I like. Somebody would go, oh, they're not really punk though, are they? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you just sit and argue about what punk rock is. You don't do that with fucking, you know, crap indeed. Rock.
But you know what I mean? But was that the same? Because when you say that, I'm thinking of The Clash.
Right.
Straight away, because people are like, oh, The Clash, well, you know, was Joe Strummer from Public School?
I don't know.
Yeah, he was.
I feel like, but at the same time, The Clash did actually change their sound and actually, you know, took what they had their beginning and then changed it into other things. Blur, Damon Albarn had the same backlash for Mockney, didn't he, essentially? Yeah. I don't know what my point is.
And the Clash, someone in The Clash in Good, the Bad and the Queen, who
were on the telly.
There they are right now.
Actually, you can see Damon just saying, country, over and over again.
With his whistly S's.
Oh, that's annoying.
Oh, I can hear it.
That's really good.
The Tommy Robinson thing, it was amazing for me watching it. As you know, you fucking stuck to him. How was it for you? you know, to sort
it's
of
not
have...
my proud. It's not my proudest moment. I know why I did it. I did it because I'd had a really, really good night the night before, singing my favourite song, which is Dirty Boy by the Cardiacs. Oh, yeah. I sang that, nice. And then I had a really good time, got really hammered afterwards, and the next day I was on the train, trekked myself to first class, and I was on the train with Gary Lineker, feeling like $1 million, and then I got off the train at Piccadilly, and I saw the artist formerly known as Tommy Robinson, and quickly did the maths in my addled head. Well, okay, I mean, come on then, keyboard warrior, what are you going to say? Go on.
Yeah.
I was like, well, if I go up to him and call him a Nazi prick, he's either going to punch me in the face, and that's fine. They'll get locked up, that's cool. So if he doesn't do that, then that's cool as well. So I just went up and did it.
Yeah.
And
how did you do it?
I went up to him about as far away as you are now and went, you fucking Nazi prick!
Wow, okay.
He was with his wife, who he's prone to knocking about and getting locked up for the privilege of.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still a proud husband, you know. Anyway, he long story short, he went absolutely raj. Videoed me, called, you know, like, he was like, why am I Nazi? Why am I Nazi? And I told him why I thought he was a Nazi, because he uses hate speech and makes a whole lot of money from it and spreads a lot of fucking propaganda. And
it was, yeah, like, watching the video back, you know, he's there saying, give me a quote, give me evidence. Yeah. It's like, just because the sticks aren't in your hand,
yeah,
don't let me think that I can't see the big art attack that you're doing in your back garden here.
This well, is like, to me, you know, he said, well, he called me a scumbag and said, well, the Nazis killed millions of Jews. I said, well, they didn't do that on day one, though, did they?
Mm.
They were Nazis before they killed anyone.
It took about 10 years for that.
I said, what did they do on day one? He says, hate speech. He says, well, there you fucking go. And then after that, immediately after that, I realised that everybody in the taxi queue behind me was on his side. And I realised that... And then people were like...
Really? Is that so?
Oh, yeah.
Piccadilly Station?
Yeah. Like,
fuck me.
People coming up and fucking having a go at me. You're a fucking ball bag and all this. You're a fucking wee dick. And like, I looked at everybody in the queue and went, are y'all seeing this? And nobody spoke up at all. I was like, now I'm in trouble. Because I thought if this guy's gonna if he's gonna start on me and it's gonna get nasty, then somebody'll step in. Because not everybody is a prick, and I was wrong. They were all. I was totally outnumbered. So I was like, time to shut up.
Talking about what it means to be English and why we're in such shit at the moment. There's two perfect examples there, aren't there? To be a sort of career shock jock right wing fucking well, Nazi, like you say, and then the people in the taxi line with absolute apathy to the entire situation, which is equally as bad, really.
Well, people were coming up and high fiving him, asking for pictures, you know, and it was match day, I found out, but I wouldn't know because I fucking hate football.
The other thing as well is that you have to remember that, you know, his way of doorstepping you there with his phone out. I mean, he does that every day.
Yeah. He's a pro.
It's like you throwing a guitar on him and going, "There's the Pyramid Stage." I'm not telling you which one the tuner is. Go.
He didn't get the spinal tap, unfortunately. He didn't get the Spinal Tap reference because he was like, "What's fucking wrong with you?" And I was like, "Well, if I wasn't under such heavy sedation," and he was like, "What would you do?" Fucking. And I was like, "Oh, fuck this."
I thought you reacted to that really well, and I also thought the fact that you called him Steven throughout.
Well done for staying. Thank you.
Good on you.
Yeah.
So. Online since you got a load, didn't you?
I came home feeling quite good, and I was saying to Beth, like, oh my god, something fucking amazing has just happened. So you won't believe this. And I was texting Biffy as well, because, you know, we're pals and we take
course.
I was like, this fucking, because I talk about this shit a lot, you know, they know that I fucking hate all that kind of stuff. It's like I keep saying, it's where I'm from, so it's something that I keep rallying against. And quickly it turned into an episode of Black Mirror where, like, the phone went and it's my mother saying, right, so I'm on Facebook and every picture that is tagged of you, I've got just loads of people calling me a slut. I've got loads of people saying that you're a paedophile. What the fuck have you done? What has happened? I'm like, well, I'm not a paedophile and you're not a slut. Insert your own joke here. And it quickly became a serious situation that every fucking machine in the house was getting notifications. So I had to call the cops.
Fuck, really?
Yeah, I called the cops and I had to call the fire department to come and fireproof the house because that was recommended that I do that.
Fuck off, really?
Yeah. You've got to understand, it's one of those things that I'm like, you can call me a paedophile 100 times a day. That's fine. That's funny. But when you say, like, they were trying to find out where I lived, and they thought they knew, but they'd actually found my accountant's address. But they so that went everywhere.
Bastards. I was
like, and it moved anyway.
Right. Yeah.
But it was serious. Like, that's their thing. They'd go to company's house and they like, I've got him. And you know, there's an email address on my website, and that had my address on it. Everything that we were sending out from the online shop had my address on it. Your return address. It was like, this is serious. And you know, because people on Instagram will take a picture of something that they've received from me and it'll have my address on it. I was like, I'm fucked.
Yeah.
So it was serious. You know, it's one of those things. What, you know, the last tour I did, because I had all these messages and I still get them, like, oh, we're going to come down and see you and we're going to fuck you up.
Yeah.
And so I had to go on stage every night with a tote bag with a hammer in it.
Right, fucking hell, man.
Luckily, I mean, like, if they had a come, it would have made the numbers up, because no cunt came to see me. It was dead. I would have taken the money, but it was fine.
That's outrageous. I had no idea that it was...
It was serious as fuck, but, like, I realise now that it's just they're all talk. It's fine.
Yeah.
They're all talk, and it's become sport.
Yeah.
It's just a thing I do. It's a part of my day, and none of them can answer the questions. You can point them towards videos of Stephen Yaxley Lennon being overtly and unequivocally racist.
Or blaming the entire nation. What? Not,
yeah,
not,
the,
not
the entire Muslim population.
Yeah, blame the entire Muslim population for the 7/7 bombings and things like that. Like, it's just outrageous.
Referring to an entire community in, I think it's Oddsall, the day after the Manchester bomb. So these people, this might look like a peaceful community to you, but every fucking one of these people is a fucking enemy combatant who wants to kill and maim you. It's like, fucking really? The day after the Manchester bomb, you're going to go around doing that? It's like, that's... If that ain't racism, I don't know what it fucking is. You know what I mean? So to me...
Yeah.
It's just a thing. I enjoy the sport of it now. It's...
Yeah.
But I don't feel danger. Like, there was a while I'd, like, go around town wearing only me reading... Well, not only me reading glasses. I'd wear clothes as well. But wearing reading glasses and a hat, you know, thinking... And I remember, like a few days after it, I took my son to Legoland at the Trafford Centre, and there was a couple of guys who did double takes when they saw me.
Really?
So it's stuff like that where you're like suddenly very aware. It's like, you're not a Biffy Clyro fan. Gammon boy. So
it's the Gammons.
But I mean
it's the Gammons at Crazy Golf.
I sort of fantasize a little bit that I might be in the same situation that you were in, and what I might
do. What would you do? You know?
I think I'd, even after what you've said, I think I would still do the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like you're saying, I mean, dependent on your mood and, you know, how sort of like high on life you're feeling. Mm. Like, I think I probably would. Because you're right, it needs calling out.
I don't regret it, except for the fact that my mum and my wife got, and my son got scared as fuck.
Yeah.
Not to sort of play the victim card or anything like that, but my lad knew something was fucking seriously going down.
Beth
was absolutely freaking out. So, you know, I regret that about it.
Evidence of him doing it as well. Like, there's those journalists that... was it
Mike Stushbury that he's fucking doxed, and, like, he's had all kinds of people, lunatics, come into his house.
Yeah.
Videos of Tommy, as he likes to be known, knocking on this guy's door repeatedly every night. And it's like, you know what? That's not political activism. That's just fucking thuggery. That's terrorism.
Yeah.
Get a fucking grip on it, man. Yeah. And like the idea that he's like, because he was going rage at me. He was like, I'm out with my fucking wife. You know, I fucking, if I'm on my own, you can say what you want, but I'm with my wife. I'm like, well, you know, I'm sure Hitler's fucking wife had a cross to bear as well. Yeah. You know, it's like fucking.
I'm pretty sure she knows the deal.
Yeah.
Just because you're in Pizza Express.
If you're so protective of
Toby Carver. Just because you're in Toby Carver.
I'm with my kids. It's like, but you keep getting locked up and you're addicted to cocaine. You know, like that. That's not a good parent.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, I'm going to wrap up this section, but
I don't know. Morrissey yet. Come on.
We've got a lot of time. A lot of bit of dream. I just want to say good on you, Mike.
Yeah,
honestly.
Definitely.
Really good on you,
mate. It needs to be done.
Fucking good on you. Yeah, okay.
With the benefit of hindsight, who would you now say is your favourite band or act to come from Manchester? Almost cherished.
Top of...
As it were. Yeah, it doesn't have to be like who you consider to be the best, but just who you kind of like the most at this point now.
I have a particular affinity to Elbow because they were particularly kind to Oceansize in our very early days before we got signed. Mm-hmm. And so when... Elbow started doing well immediately, you know, like as soon as they put out their first album, it was all over, and then they got the Mercury and all that, and to me it was just an incredibly moving and well deserved thing because they worked so hard. I'm proud of them.
Yeah, funnily enough, I interviewed Elbow for a website. It was really interesting chatting to them because they were. It was just before Leaders of the Free World came out, so they maybe flopped with their second record, and they were just like, we just need to make enough money to satisfy the label to carry on, and now they're this absolute behemoth.
They're not a band that I listen to at all anymore, but I still have a particular fondness for that first record because I think that at the period. That came out when I just moved to Charlton, and it just has... It's tied up with an awful lot of memories any day now, particularly. I just find there's something... And there's something a lot more sort of urban and gritty in that record. There's a sort of DJ shadowy thing to it. There's something slightly dark, the artwork and all that.
I find a Massive Attack is a really big influence on the whole, you know, that real, kind of mezzanine kind of thing they did, yeah.
I'm trying to think of another Manchester band. There's got to be one. It's real. Nod is my favourite Manchester band. Sorry, there it is. What the fuck am I talking about?
He's gone into full on dad humour there. He's not had a lot of sleep. It's all right.
I recognised, because I obviously did my homework on the way here, and recognised a tune that I'd already bought after hearing it on the radio and Shazamming it because the display didn't work on my radio.
Mm.
And it was the one with Balloon in the title.
Big Balloon.
It's got a really nice fucked up bass line on it.
What
I like about what you do also is that the chord sequences don't go where you think they're going to go, and there's a key change where you don't think there should be a key change.
It's annoying, isn't it?
As a lyricist, I love that.
Yeah, I bet you do. Tell me about it. But like I think that there's just nowhere near enough of that at the moment.
Yeah.
And...
Hey, there you go.
What was that song?
Good night.
Good night. We're going.
That song was influenced by
Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Fanfare for the Modern Man.
Yeah, I just heard it on the radio and just like, maybe another tune in that vein is due today.
Is due on six music. Just from an outsider of fans of both your music, there's a lot of crossover between fans, aren't there? You were both at the same gig. Right?
These New Puritans.
Yeah, you're both there. And you messaged me saying, oh, Mike Venart's here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I spotted you in the crowd and I was like, I could go and say hello, but... This is very cerebral moment.
We were planning for the podcast, basically, saying your name was on our list.
Right.
And I was like, "Fuck, go and talk to him."
I should have said, "I was bored to tears."
Yes,
I was not expecting that.
I love Field of Reeds. I think that's one of
Field of Reeds is amazing, but they only played one song off it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I think that's one of the best albums ever made by anyone.
Yeah, it's incredible.
But the new one doesn't do any of those things that I like about it. You know,
and it took them 6 years to do it as well.
I know. At the same time, it's not my thing. But fair play to them; they still do what the fuck they want, and that's
the
fine.
The production on the latest album is ridiculous.
Yeah.
The amount of people involved with it as well, all the musicians. We to do them a massive disservice. We were listening to it in your car, we were saying like that those strings sound fake. I reckon that's like a VST sample or something, and then got the booklet out. I was like, "No, this is like this is serious
string orchestra
recording."
Like coming from a band from us, knowing what the cost of production is on those kind of recordings. Like whenever I hear when I heard the latest Easy Per Arms, I'm just thinking, like, how much did this cost? Where did this come from? Like, where is the funding?
Yeah, I think it's purely... they're on the same label as Alt-J,
and it's a horrible question to ask.
No, but it's
very cynical. Like you know, inherently, it's quite a cynical thing. But because the music is great. Like, what they do is great. But I'm just there thinking, how have they made this happen? This is something we should kind of get towards on the crowdfunding thing. Because you, Neil, you asked us specifically to watch the Kate Nash documentary.
I've not seen that
on iPlayer. Is it Underestimate the Girl?
Yeah. Underestimate you, yes.
Underestimate the Girl. It's a really conflicted piece of work.
Right.
Like, if I was to put it in a soundbite, it's not something that you could put in a soundbite. To be honest, we could do a whole goddamn episode on that film alone. But there is a moment where she does go to Kickstarter. She crowdfunds her latest album, and her target is $70,000. She reaches that, she doubles it, she gets to 140. She then decides that they need 150 in order to actually properly promote the album. I hate saying record. So to properly promote her album, which I think is farcical in like, it's just deluded in so many respects. Where does $150,000 become the appropriate budget line for any album? I mean,
What was your crowdfunding of Pledge Music total?
About your Kickstarters and your pledges and all that, it's a system of diminishing returns. People are more than happy to get excited about putting their hand in their pocket the first time. The second time, you'd be lucky if you get half that.
So why did you do the recent record without Pledge?
The first album I did, it with a record label. So Super Bowl, who Oceanside were signed to, were very keen for me to work with them again. And, you know, if there's a deal on the table, I'll take it. The signing of the deal was a little less extravagant than I would have liked. I signed it over a bowl of cornflakes.
Did you not get a bump? Did you get a bumper
check? In my kitchen. There was no fucking champagne. There was no, you know...
Yeah,
plate,
not even a
cured
pizza.
Meats. There's no cocaine. I was in pajamas. You know. So I did that, and then basically the deal was, quite frankly, they were like, look, we're going to give you fucking £20 to make this album, and I said, well, fuck you, I'll go to Pledge Music and I'll do it myself. And they went, okay, well, we'll give you £10, but we'll pay for the pressing of the record.
Okay.
And you can have X amount of stock to sell on Pledge, and then we'll put it out.
Right, okay.
So that was the deal. I was like, that sounds pretty good. So I did that, and yeah, it was great. Really good fun, really exciting. You got to understand as well, for me, it was like, yeah, certainly now I'm a dad and all that, I want to make sure that the money's going the right fucking way, because I've spent an awful lot of time going, hey, wait a minute, you know. You know, the fucking record deals are weighted so insanely. You know, you're just like, you know, seeing how it goes with... Hang on a minute, let me get this right. The way that it's sort of weighted, and the way that it was always sold to you, was that if you buy a £10 CD, £1 of that goes to the band, right? But nobody's telling you where that fucking £9 is going. The idea is that you are unrecouped. You owe the record label X amount of money, and that money is only getting paid back from your £1 that you are owed.
Yeah.
Nobody ever says, where's that £9 going?
I think about that. Yeah, I've
the record
that
company
recently.
Earns their money back long before you fucking start.
Most of the narrative is, well, the record is X amount in the hole, so next time I'll have to spend less. But the hole isn't actually...
The hole isn't as deep as they're making out.
It's not really a hole.
No.
Because you never see the full sort of, like, scope of how well it really... in a currency sense, anyway.
No.
It's not about the money, is it?
No, it's about the art, man.
But this is it. It's holding artists to that sentiment, really, the whole experience. Is it like, how, I mean, in terms of going on Kickstarter and putting a project across, how did it make you feel as an artist to do such a thing?
It's one of the most enjoyable and fulfilling experiences of my life, because at the time, you know, I'd been 5 years playing for Biffy but not releasing music and not writing music. I was fucking totally dumbfounded, didn't know what I was going to do. And then we had this record in the can. We put it up on Pledge, and every fucking Apple device in the house was going bananas for like weeks and weeks and weeks, just notifications. And yeah, it's notifications that there's money coming in, but it's notifications that people all over the world are fucking really keen to hear what you're going to do. That just meant the absolute world to me. It was a really, really exciting time. I regret the record could have been a bit better, but you know, that everybody kind of liked it. But yeah, I didn't go with it this time because, well, they wouldn't do me. I asked Pledge, like, cause I know that they'd, a couple of other people who are big Pledge earners, that, not that I'm a big Pledge earner, I knew that they'd been cut a deal that they could get, like, they wouldn't take as big a cut. So I was like, I'm going to try it as well. They went, no, we still want the same amount. I was like, fuck it. I'll just do it on my website. And it worked out much the same. It's like, just did it all myself and did it cheap. And yeah, you know how I do it, man. You just do the fucking drums at some place and then do all the rest in your bedroom, you know. I basically sort of creatively just fucking lost my mind because I didn't know how to write a song. There's a couple of songs on the last Oceanside album that I wrote all on my own. Those are the only songs I'd ever written on my own at that point. And so I was playing with Biffy. I was trying to do this and that and it wasn't working. I couldn't write. Just couldn't write at all. And then I had a kid, and you can't do anything when you've had a kid. You can't barely construct a fucking sentence. When Vic hit sort of one and a half, two, we started sending him to like nursery for, I think it was 3 hours a day, three times a week. And as soon as that started happening, I wrote an album in fucking 2 months, because it's suddenly like I had the clarity, the drive, the ambition, and I just had a shitload of songs sat around, not finished. It was like, fucking go for it. And I also had a couple of little bits of software that I found really inspiring. I was just shitting songs. And also, anything that I couldn't finish, I was giving to Steve out of Oceanside. Me and Steve and Gambler have always stayed really tight. Our relationship predates Oceanside, so I'm just really glad that it survived the fucking awful shit that happened at the end of that band. So, yeah, I just banged it out and I found my feet. It took a long time to work out. The thing is as well, at the end of that band, I was like, oh, this is it now. I can do whatever I want. I've been restricted for so long. You know, I can really fucking make that Pavement album I've always fucking wanted to make. And the thing is you suddenly, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And you have like option paralysis because you think you can do all these things and you, but you can't. You've got to focus. And what I realized that it's just practice. I'm not able to. When I was in Oceanside, I was like, oh, I'll just sit around and get stoned and wait for the fucking magic to happen. But it doesn't.